Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the wonderful world of Ron Muick. It's a very personal exhibition, and I would like to offer a personal sort of perspective on how I think about it, what it does for me. It's really, I mean, I guess when you come around the corner, there's really nothing that prepares you for this sort of thing. It's absolutely unlike anything we've really seen in New Zealand before. The only thing that really has any comparable sort of quality about it is the Dwayne Hansen exhibition, which came round in the late 1980s, Real People, where this American sculptor presented lifelike and life-size images of Americans and various people doing everyday things like being tourists or hobos and things like that. So that, in a way, they're similar, but in a lot of ways so very different. And as I said, there's really nothing like these. So I'd like to congratulate Christchurch Art Gallery on bringing this experience to New Zealand. It's unfortunate that perhaps no one else in New Zealand, no other cities in New Zealand are going to get to see it, but it's wonderful to have it here. My sort of own introduction, sort of ordeal by fire in a sense, with Ron Muick occurred in London in the late 1990s when he was only recently sort of established and getting going. And I happened to go to one of Charles Saatchi's galleries there in Boundary Road, and there was a show, I think it was called New Neurotic Realism, and a collection of some of Saatchi's recent acquisitions. And there were three or four of early Ron Muick sculptors in there. And of course, I was absolutely unprepared for them, and as I was for most of the material in this exhibition, that was all by artists that I hadn't heard of. And of course, they're all big names now, but this was just, it was exciting to sort of be there when this stuff was just being unleashed on the public. And so, much like one does here, sort of came around the corner and saw one or two of Ron Muick's things. I was absolutely staggered by them. And of course, the thing that you have to grapple with initially is this business of scale. He's constantly manipulating it. So everything is either much smaller or much larger than life. He seems to have an aversion to actually dealing on a one-to-one scale. There's nothing in here that's actually, and I'm not sure if he's ever actually done anything that's actual life size. He seems to go for this very small or very large. And I've come to the conclusion that whether they're very smaller than life or whether they're larger than life, they're all larger than life. Because in a sense, when they're smaller, it sort of concentrates the effect, and it sort of draws you in, and you sort of peer at these things sort of with a greater intensity, I guess. And of course, it goes without saying that the larger ones are just so magnificent in their detail that they too draw you in and are much larger than life. But I had this, seeing these things for the first time in the Saatchi Gallery in the late 1980s, once I'd got over the experience of seeing these, it was interesting, as I'm sure happens in this very exhibition, standing back and watching others having their sort of initiation into a Ron Muick sculpture, dealing with this material for the first time and coping with it and sort of just trying to work out what it's all about. Now, actually, I'm a bit of a fan for Bob Dylan, and a line occurred to me today when I was wandering around, and it's, "He not busy being born is busy dying." And because it seems to me that everything Ron Muick does is concerned with some aspect of life or death, and the things in between. And so if we turn to Mask, for example, Mask 2, here he is sleeping. And I understand that you know, sleep is sort of like a near-death experience. It's as close as we get to it without actually dying. So here he is, sort of oblivious to us, exposing himself for our scrutiny. I mean, it's a very bold and magnificent thing to do. There's a book, Laura Cumming, an English writer, has recently done a magnificent book on self-portraits called A Face to the World. And she talks about the first mask that Ron Muick did. And apparently he did it in response to his children, his two young daughters, who had trouble getting them to bed. They were a bit unruly, and so he had to sort of exercise some sort of paternal control over them. And he was sort of trying to, I mean, this is according to Laura Cumming, he was trying to exercise a bit of control and get them upstairs to bed. And it, so it led him to sort of thinking what it was like to impose a larger than life sort of image on someone, in the sense, so what he did with his Mask 1 was to actually give a sense of a sculpture that would appear larger to an average sized human, in the same way that that perhaps we seem large to a small child. So that was allegedly the the background to Mask One, and this one is a sequel to this. What I like about this is it's not sort of dictatorial in the sense that perhaps the first one was, but it's monumental. And to me, it has this sort of timeless quality. It sort of reminds me of one of those perhaps Easter Island or Rapa Nui sort of figures. It's sort of fallen over and it's there, you know, and it's been there for eternity and it's going to be there for a long time. And of course, Ron is sound asleep there. You can almost feel a bit of a snore coming on, the sort of the way the lips are opened. So it's a very placid, it's a very timeless sort of piece, and it's about, I guess, the gap in between being born, which we see through there, and dying, which is the first sculpture that we come in. So for me, Ron's sculptures are about the very aspect of our being, the being born and the dying and the bits in between. And in that sense, they're quite different from the only other sort of comparable work, the Dwayne Hansen sculptures, which have more to do with people dressing up, wearing clothes and actually doing something, whereas Ron's are just being, I think, and they're just being us in our various stages of our lives and living. So, any response or questions, or what do you, how do you respond to something like this? Any thoughts? Or?
You should have a shave.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? This incredible attention to detail, which just gives these things a sort of allure. You just want to get up and sort of touch them and just, come to grips with this mind-numbing sort of detailing that he's so good at. It's quite staggering. There really is nothing else like these. And if you see the film, the process that he goes through, it's understandable.
The detail is, in a way, something that sucks you straight past it. You don't see the I see the detail and suddenly I'm sucked inside.
Yes.
To know what's happening inside.
Yes.
Inside this person, whatever it is.
Well,
all of them, really.
And then the nice thing is to come round here and you realise it's just a shell, that it's just a mask and it's just a veneer, really. It's just our facial features are just on the outside because there's nothing there, and he's made absolutely no attempt to pretend that it's a realistic giant figure. It is just a facial veneer. And of course, it corresponds or contrasts very, very dramatically with Dead Dad round the corner, which is about half life size. So this, I guess, is probably about four or five times life size. So he's really manipulating the natural order of things, and even more so with the newly born baby further round, which is many times life size. So it's part of his thing. It's his sort of signature, I guess, to actually manipulate those things and not deal with things on a one-to-one scale.
Do you have an idea yourself why he might choose to make them larger, certain sculptures smaller, some larger?
No, there doesn't seem to be a lot of perhaps reason for it, except that I think we can probably say that his older subjects are smaller, and when people get frail and elderly, they in a sense you feel this nurturing thing for you. If you've ever had an elderly parent who's dying in a hospital bed, you sort of can see them wither away, and a person who was once strong and you looked up to and was bigger than you and is now sort of, the natural order of things, they're withering away. You have this sort of sense of them sort of getting smaller and smaller. So I guess the largest figure in this show, I think, is the newly born baby. I mean, which is massive. So perhaps he's sort of saying that it's all a little bit, from there on things are sort of, he's not busy being born, is busy dying. That process is underway.
Would you
see it as part of a self-portraiture kind of tradition?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's more than... I mean, well, this is very much a self-portrait. And we know this is Ron, but and we know that's his father around there. But I think the main point of the rest of them is that they're anonymous people. We don't know who they are, but they are actual people, and I guess they do look like the models. But they're more, by virtue of being anonymous and of no one in particular, they're more universal, so that I think we can relate to them and we can see the stages of our lives, our progress in them. We're not. I mean, I guess if you knew Ron Murek well, you would be rather overwhelmed by the likeness, or otherwise, that this sculpture presents. But because, you know, I don't know him, or I've seen the film, but you know, what we're looking at is a state of humanity, someone asleep, and in the same way that all the other sculptures are about stages of living or dying, getting old, or being born. Or a man in a boat, you know, is that a metaphor for life's journey? The elderly woman with the sticks, you know, that's the bundle of sticks on her back. That's sort of, you know, life, that the challenge of life, that the hardships we endure. So I think they're all about the life process and the challenges we are required to endure. So they are more than self. I mean, this is more than a self portrait. But they're what we want to see into them, and I think we can see ourselves in these very clearly.
One of the things about portraits, it seems to me, is often the accoutrements, the things that are associated with the person. And yet here we've given no context. In fact, very few of them, none of them really, have given any context. Is this replicated elsewhere in portraiture?
Well,
it's
more of a modern approach. I mean, traditionally, painted portraits 300 or 400 years ago, it was commonplace to load the canvas with all manner of references. So you're actually providing as much information about the subject as you can. You know, references to their family and background and all that. But now we've sort of got over that one a bit, and in fact I'll show some images later of portraits which are painted portraits which are the equivalent of this, where you have sort of a face sort of cropped, you know, full canvas, without any other indications of who that person might be. Yeah, I mean, we can accept portraiture as a more direct sort of record of someone without having to have all this sort of didactic material sort of telling us, you know, informing us who it is. I guess it's a matter of being able to appreciate something as a work of art without it being, without our opinion being modified by knowing who the person is, as if that would make a difference to the quality of the work. So you have to absolutely focus on the work itself, not the knowledge of not the background knowledge.
Something I find sort of humorous about this work, and that was looking at it with my 11-year-old son that sort of drew it out. Really was, you know, he's asleep, he's on his side, and it's as if he's, you know, oblivious to everyone else in the room. But he has this giant ear.
Yes. listening. Yes.
As if he's going to sort of, you know, spring you at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, you know, when you look at it with someone who isn't looking at it through the eyes of an art historic tradition, that you think, oh, that guy's got big ears.
Yeah.
But, you know, I thought that was just another. You know, that he seems a lot more alert than he actually is. Who knows? Who knows what's going on?
Yeah, sort of listening, watching.
Let me say this, Sarah, because this is the first time I've stood at this spot looking at this work for such a long period of time. And I've noticed, like, his eyelids, even though they're completely shut, there's almost like a slit almost peeking out at us from this angle. But I haven't noticed it until now when I came around to you, because usually I'm walking past it. I didn't notice the looking down, peering out, maybe.
I think there's an as such as the attention to detail and the realism here, that you're sort of expecting the eyelids to flicker or him to sort of, you know, the lips to sort of quiver or something to happen. I think it's... Well, that's right. You expect a little bit of drool to sort of come out of the corner of the mouth. Yeah. All the the ear to flick or something like that. It's and I think that's the power of these things, that they're sort of paused. They're sort of between. They've got this sort of potential for. Well, for life, of course, but for imminent movement, you know, you're just expected of something that looks so darn real.
Yeah. I don't know whether anyone else feels this. I think they're more demanding than any other sculpture I've looked at. They demand an intimacy that other sculptures don't.
Yes. Yes.
Not engage with them, and you're drawn as a person.
Yes.
And exposed by what you're
seeing. Well, because they're dealing with such absolutely fundamental issues. Yeah. Mm. Yes. I mean, I keep referring to the Dwayne Hansen sculptures, which, are you familiar with them? They're sort of, there was a famous one of a couple of American tourists with the cameras around, you know, the typical American tourists with loud shirts and sort of the cameras, great Pentax cameras around their necks or Nikons or whatever. I mean, they're very impressive to look at, but they are sort of photorealist copies of something. So that, but they're not. I mean, I guess they're dealing with an aspect of American life, but they're not dealing with anything as fundamental as this. And I think you're absolutely right that these draw you in, because there is no other baggage. There are no other props. You just get the barest of essentials: a little naked man in a boat, or an elderly woman with a bunch of sticks. I mean, he's got nothing, you know. And so the focus is entirely on.
On,
yes, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
You seem to have an inner life.
Yes.
Even this one, with his eyes closed. And, I mean,
yeah.
You think he's there.
Yes.
And there's something going on.
Yeah.
There's some sort of inner existence.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's the beauty of them, that he has captured. That for all that slavish attention to detail, that they're not dead, they're alive. And as I said, there's no pretense to making it real. I mean, you walk around here and you see this is just a veneer of a face, but it's a face that looks like it could just wake up and be part of this, engage with us. Yes. Yeah.
Maybe there's a building up a wee bit of a tradition of habit of portraying people asleep. I mean, the artist did David Beckham at Stretts.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And I mean,
there's a video, yeah.
You do see that twitching and movement.
Yeah,
But it's very slow. Drawing.
But I think he'd had a hard day at practicing, hadn't he? So he needed the rest.
Thanks very much, Richard.
Oh, thank you.
Snapshot. Yeah, look forward to the extended version.
All right. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Oh, well, it'll be good to see you later if that's thank you. Yeah.